Audi.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, I'm Lisa Francesca-Nand and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. Our guest today has had an extraordinary career so far, excelling in music, creating film scores and writing and indeed appearing in some of the most iconic television of recent UK TV history. All of that whilst also qualifying as an accountant. He grew up in Kent, his parents not long emigrated from India, being regularly attacked by supporters of the National Front, but found his love of music saved him. After meeting fellow future media personality Sanjeev Bhaskar and teaming up to create a comedy show, his star very quickly rose through not just comedy on radio and then TV, but also in music and making film scores, and worked with just about every important figure in modern day music. From the moment he first went to India, age 8, a trip that he describes as having turned life into Technicolor, his love of travel, culture and worldwide music have fed not just his creative output, but also the political fire that sees him speaking out against injustice and inequality. His background, work, music, culture and passions have, in his own words, enabled him to truly feel like a citizen of the world. Let's give Nitin Sawhney a proper Big Travel Podcast introduction. Nitin Sawhney's Kent childhood included regular attacks by racists, but he threw himself into music, joining school friend James Taylor's band. Flying to India via Kabul, aged 8, he found himself a child mascot, riding horseback through the streets. He felt liberated by Liverpool at university. He's recorded with musicians in Australia, Brazil, South Africa, Spain, interviewed Nelson Mandela at his home in Johannesburg, discussing everything from the connection between flamenco and Rajasthani gypsies, working with Gary Lineker and refugees on his new album, being held at security in LA before being sent to hospital, and so much more. It's Nitin Sawhney. Thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure.
I feel like I'm having an immersion into Indian, my Indian side, because I'm half Indian as well, half Indian Fijian, this week, because last night I was on stage at the Indian High Commission interviewing Bethany Hughes, who I think
who I know.
A friend of yours. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
From years ago, from Waterman's Arts Centre, when she used to book Sanj and I for comedy shows, comedy nights.
Oh, really? Quite mad. Where it was from?
Yeah, long time ago. Yeah.
Well, she's doing so well at the moment. And I was interviewing her about her Channel 4 show, The Treasures of India.
Yeah, she's great. I mean, it's great. She's very knowledgeable and very, really good at what she does.
I feel like, so we were immersed in that sort of culture, which was wonderful. Everyone was wearing saris and we had like a little drinks reception with sort of Indian tapas and everything afterwards.
That's great.
It got me thinking, actually, as to what sort of immigrants there are out there. My dad, who came from he's 100% Indian blood, but he was a product of indentured labour. So he was his grandparents came to Fiji, went to Fiji from India under British rule, which was essentially, I'm sure you know all about it, but essentially sort of a big abuse of human rights and, you know, sort of akin to slave labour with a tiny bit of money sort of thrown in. But then when he came, he was third generation, when he came to England in the 60s, he ditched it all, you know. So I have no Indian culture, whatever. I'm sort of learning, you know, as I got older, I learned to embrace it more.
Flamenco is partially Indian culture.
It is, yes, absolutely. Oh. I found that out through my brother, but we grew, a big coincidence, but my dad took us to live in Spain because he needed somewhere warm, and actually warm and more liberal when we went in the 80s. We were living in the north of England, which was very a difficult place to be for him as an immigrant at the time. But I'm wittering on about this because it got me thinking that there's different types of immigrants who come to this country. And my dad was one of the ones that just forgot it all. You know, I don't know any Hindi. I didn't have any culture. And actually, as a child, I was quite glad of that. I'm embarrassed to admit, because I didn't want to stand out. You know, I wanted to be like all my little white friends and just be one of them. But it sounds bringing this around to you, because this is about you rather than me, it sounds like you had the opposite. You were one of the born of immigrant families. Your family just came to Rochester, is it? From
Well, originally they lived in London for a year before they came down to Rochester, yeah.
And it sounds to me like they kept that cultural involvement. And I think it's a wonderful thing that they did. But growing up for you in the Southeast, there might have been some challenges.
Yeah, there were. I mean, it was Chatham, I think, was at the time was the headquarters of the National Front during the 70s. I mean, it was an aggressive place for a lot of lunatic skinheads and kind of, you know, Nazi type idiots. But I mean, yeah, it was kind of who were pretty violent around our area. But even the kids, you know, where a lot of the kids where I went to school were really influenced by that. A lot of their parents were National Front members, and also I had teachers who were National Front members. You know, it was a really horrible experience in that way. Having said that, you know, there were lots of good times as well. But yeah, it was kind of, and I kind of was in bands and had a good time with a lot of friends. But it was it was difficult. It was a difficult time.
Was it? Did you feel lucky to have that musical involvement that you actually found something that was cool, I guess, and allowed you to sort of, you know, integrate with a group of people in that sense, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think being in bands actually was a good thing, because you know, it kind of gave you a bit more social kind of gravitas, I guess, you know, in school. So I mean, you know, actually playing instruments or being in groups was a cool thing to do. So from that point of view, everything got better from that time. But I didn't really think of it that way. It was more, you know, I'd always been a musician, and so I was lucky that I had that. But you know, it was I think more than anything, really, music was what helped me just kind of get past a lot of racist attacks and violence that I kind of saw and experienced.
Were you physically attacked?
Oh, a lot. Yeah, all the time. yeah. So certainly between 11 and 13 years old, I was attacked pretty much every day. Yeah.
In what sort of form? That sounds absolutely hideous.
About 8 kids would kind of wait for me. You know, it was pretty full on. I mean, but having said that, it was a long time ago, and I've kind of been in therapy over the last 10 years, and kind of, you know, there were certain kids who would wait for me, you know, outside the classroom and stuff like that. And, you know, it was just relentless. And I think it's because there wasn't anyone else, you know. And the thing is, if you're Asian and there's only white people around you, you stand out. And kids who are aggressive at that age are looking for someone to, you know, pick on because they look different or they act differently. So from that point of view, it was just kind of, I mean, it went on for quite a long time. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, I suppose it kind of motivated me to kind of, you know, play more music and just kind of and do things really to actually accentuate my identity rather than hide it. So I kind of, you know, I was always, when I'd been, although I was a classically trained pianist, I mean, in Western classical music, and I got into jazz and other things, and I got into flamenco young, I kind of found myself playing a lot of Indian classical rags in the music rooms, despite the fact that I got thrown out for doing that by a music teacher who was a member of the National Front. You know, it's kind of it was one of the things that I just enjoyed, just trying to find ways into understanding my heritage.
I will sort of take it. Well, to me, it is all about travel. And I think I've spent a lot of time in Southeast London and Kent. And it's one of those, I realised that Kent is a place of travel to many people, Garden of England. But it's one of those places of huge contrast where you've got a lot of wealthy people in said Garden of England, but also as the port into this country, and maybe that's connected to the pockets of the National Front, of course, Britain First, Nigel Farage, you know, those people are there and still there. So it is a very interesting, a sort of contrasting place like that. And I think a lot of people don't sort of realise, they see it as this pretty Garden of England.
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, you know, having said that, it was a beautiful place to grow up. I enjoyed a lot of things about growing up in Rochester, and I don't think I'd change it. I mean, I would change certain aspects of what happened, but I think, you know, in a way, a lot of stuff. I mean, yeah, ultimately, you're the sum product of your experiences, and so you know, you take the good with the bad, or the bad with the good, Ron. So it was kind of it was beautiful. We lived by the river. You know, there was a castle, a cathedral. It's, you know, near the bridge, and it was, yeah, it was a lovely experience. Just kind of walking around there, running there, doing stuff. You know, having friends there. That was great. You know, I really enjoyed that. Going, you know, as I got older, going into country pubs in that area. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of great stuff that I enjoyed, and kind of, you know, it mellowed out over time. It was kind of at the heyday of the National Front. It was at its worst. So that was when I was around kind of between 11 and 13. Yeah, because that would have been, I think it got particularly bad between 1975 to, yeah, 77 kind of thing.
From a subculture point of view, you also don't know who's a racist skinhead and who's just an aesthetic skinhead to you in that time. And I remember, you know, as a small child being very afraid of anyone with a shaven head because of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, what a lot of people don't realise, when, you know, it's interesting, say, for example, with the proms at the Royal Albert Hall, a lot of people don't understand why certain Asians and so on have an issue with the Union Jack. And it's because we'd see skinheads when we were young, all wearing the Union Jack, about, you know, desperate to kind of kick your head in or to attack you. And so we had an association of the Union Jack with that. Whereas a lot of, you know, white people don't really have that association as much, because they didn't have that confrontation constantly. So when you do see the proms and you see people waving Union Jacks, I mean, the controversy today is that a whole load of Brexiters are kind of upset that people were waving the European Union flags at the Royal Albert Hall. So I've just invited people to bring their own EU flags and wave them at the Royal Albert Hall at my gig.
I love it. No, you're right. It's about association, isn't it? And you get the older generation who say, oh, well, I don't know why you can't use you know, words that have changed, you know, coloured or whatever. It's actually, it doesn't really matter. It's just that if it's offensive to some people and upsetting and triggering, and it's been misappropriated by one group of people, then let's just avoid it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I realise that we've been stuck on Kent for a while, but when you were younger, did you travel to Delhi? Did they take you home, as it were?
Yeah, I travelled to India and went to even Jaipur and to Chandigarh and Nabha, you know, around the Punjab area, Rajasthan, you know, around those kinds of areas, Jalandhar as well. The Punjab was the focus of where we travelled, and that was really quite idyllic. So I was about 8 years old when I first went to India, and that was the first time I'd ever been abroad. So I was blown away by, first of all, the whole idea of traveling on a plane. I remember just being absolutely astounded at looking out of a window and seeing that we were that high up. But also, you know, the things, odd things, like I remember the taste of the food on that plane. You know, it was very special. And I remember we stopped off in Kabul on the way to India. And it was kind of... it was the first time I'd seen people with machine guns. You know, there were security people carrying machine guns, and we were left on the tarmac for quite a while. At one point, where I felt my head was on fire. It was so hot. But yeah, I mean, I kind of, when I got to India, I was blown away by everything. I mean, it was. I remember particularly because I was kind of asleep in the back of the car at one point, and I remember kind of looking up and seeing these beautiful trees, and everything seemed so clear. You know, the sky was stunning, and you know, you could really see the stars, and there was something quite magical about it. And I hadn't really seen that before. I'd always had this kind of childish wonderment at this kind of Taj Mahal lamp that my mum and dad had. And that was my only kind of real reference for what India was. It was a kind of a emblematic kind of, you know, way of thinking about India or reflecting on what India was. So I kind of would always just look at that and always dream about going there. So when I was actually there, and I ended up at my uncle's wedding in Nabha, and I was what's known as a Sabala, which is like a child mascot kind of thing. So I was kind of I was on a horse with him, kind of riding through with my uncle as the groom, riding through the streets of Nabha with a brass band playing When the Saints Go Marching In out of tune around me, which was the weirdest experience ever. And I kind of burst into tears because I couldn't deal with how out of tune they were playing. And so they must have thought I was the most precocious little brat. But the thing was, I kind of also remember just thinking how kind everyone was and being astonished by so many things about how people could live in such a simple way, so elegantly. I was just amazed by so much about India. Yeah, incredible.
It's a culture shock at the best of times, isn't it, India, let alone when you're 8 years old and you're stopping in Kabul and there's machine guns, and then you're on the back of a horse and, you know, it's a feast of...
No, it was on the front of the horse.
On the front of the horse, yeah, of course, yeah. It's a feast of scents and sights and noise and
it was
overwhelming heat.
What was interesting was my mum said to me at the time that I'd adapted really well and quickly. I think it's because I was so excited all the time, and I think I found everything really interesting, and I was really amazed by the rhythms that I'd hear in the streets as well, people playing dholak or even the dhol or tabla or whatever, or, you know, people playing shanai or bansuri in places. And I was kind of amazed by all of this kind of rich palette of sound, and as well as colors and smells and everything. You know, it was kind of the food, everything just felt, like you said, it was an assault on the senses, but in a really good way. I thought it was quite, it felt like I'd been living in a black and white world, you know, and suddenly somebody had switched the light on and introduced me to colour.
So you went to university in Liverpool. Was that a similar black and white to a colourful world experience? I mean, I love Liverpool. I'm from the Wirral, and my dad moved to Liverpool in the 60s when he came over from Fiji and got involved in the whole scene there with the Beatles, you know, who were playing in the cavern at that point. Ooh, and, you know, it's just, you know, as a musician, you know, did you feel that sense that I love about, not everyone gets this about Liverpool, but if you get Liverpool, you know, it is a really wonderful place.
Yeah, there were some really good bands there as well. And I used to play with some of the jazz bands there. I kind of would go out and play a few odd gigs with people. And I was studying law, but I wasn't really studying law. I was kind of more interested in the scene out there. And you know, I saw a lot of bands play there. I remember seeing Curtis Mayfield come to Liverpool University and play there, which was fantastic. That was an incredible gig. One of the best bands live I've ever seen. I was just astonished by the fact that I suddenly had this newfound freedom, and that I was talking to a lot of people who were very accepting of me as a person without kind of judging me on the basis of my colour or cultural heritage. So it was kind of, I wasn't used to that, to be honest. I mean, I remember having a conversation even in the sixth form with someone I knew and thought of as a friend, who actually said, well, everyone's a bit racist, you have to just accept that. And I remember thinking, well, maybe he knows, maybe I'm just ignorant. So that's what I mean. At that age, it was right up to the age of 18, I was kind of just brought up with this idea that racism was normalized. So I guess when I got to university and people were telling me how they'd studied, you know, at school, how they'd studied Sikhism, or they'd studied other forms of religion, where at my school, which is a grammar school in Rochester, all we'd studied really was Christianity. And it was a very strict diet of Christianity, from assembly to everything else. I kind of was amazed that, you know, a white person was sitting there and telling me about, you know, stuff that I didn't know about other cultures, and particularly Hinduism and Sikhism. Well, not Hinduism so much, but Sikhism, yeah.
I'm listening to you now. I kind of, you know, I'm a mum of two young boys, and I kind of wish that any young person who's going through, you know, what you went through at school could actually hear you speak and know that the, you know, that it's going to be okay when you're, you know, immersed in that horribleness. It must be awful.
Well, it's, I mean, one thing I would say, I mean, you know, it's also, this is why I feel strongly, so strongly and passionately about politics all the time, because the government has a bloody responsibility to children to not act like role models for idiot bullies at school. And the problem is this government doesn't get that. And they constantly, you know, Suella Braverman and Priti Patel and Sajid Javid, you know, all the Home Secretaries of this Tory government have just been constantly pushing this agenda of demonising or dehumanising people on the basis of where they're from, to the point where they try to force people to accept that it's normal. And it's absolutely disgusting. It's so disgusting to me, because that is just kind of playground fodder for bullies. They use that. They absorb it at a subliminal level, and it's used to fuel a lot of targeting of people on the basis of difference.
And you're absolutely right. And it's the, you know, the three that you mentioned, you know, coming from immigrant families themselves, you know, a racist could go, well, look, we've got these guys in the government and they're saying this. It kind of almost makes it worse.
Yeah, it does, of course. And that's the thing, you know, it's kind of, I said to someone recently that it's very carefully placed inviting window dressing for a shop that sells right-wing paraphernalia. You know, it's kind of, it's a trickery, you know, it's an illusion that's created to actually add credibility to a government that has zero credibility.
I can absolutely see where you're, you know, political, that sort of sense of fighting injustice and unfairness comes from. So you're at Liverpool, and you met Sanjeev Bhaskar there,
I didn't meet him there.
Oh, you didn't? Okay, fair enough.
I met him at University of Hertfordshire, which at the time was Hatfield Polytechnic. So because I studied accountancy there afterwards, which I was doing a foundation course in accountancy, and he was doing a business studies degree. So we kind of met there, and then we were doing, we ended up doing a comedy act even there, which at the time was called the Bargy Boys. and then later on, we turned it into the Secret Asians. But it was kind of, that was how we met, and we got on really well. But I mean, at school, I'd gone to school with James Taylor from the James Taylor Quartet, and I used to play, I ended up playing in his band as well, which is cool.
Yeah, I mean, these are really, you know, I don't know whether, you know, what comes first, creative people attract other creative people, but you've all ended up incredibly successful.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, actually. I mean, you know, Sanj and I have had very parallel careers and lives. I mean, we're still very good friends, and it can, you know, it's quite odd. You know, he got an OBE, I got a CBE. We kind of like also have you know, met lots of people that we idolized when we were younger through totally different paths, and you know, we've even ended up working with the same people or knowing the same people just by coincidence. You know, Andy Circus happens to be a very good friend of both of us independently. But there's a lot of that, you know, that's happened over time where we found, I mean, even at college or rather university, we had a kind of, you know, a bond that was quite bizarre, because we'd have lots of coincidences. I mean, I do have a lot of coincidences anyway with lots of people and with lots of things, but I did experience them a lot with him. I mean, to the point where I remember we were in a music room one time and at university, and I played one note on the piano, which is a middle C, and we both, I think it was in 1986, I think we both looked at each other and said, it must have been before that note, maybe 84. We both said film 84 at the same time from one note.
Right. Yeah.
Or another time when somebody walked into the student union bar, and they actually walked a little bit robotically, and we both looked at each other and said Gort. Now, Gort was a robot. Now there's been a film since made about it, or a revision of that film, another version of that film since. But at that time, hardly anyone knew about this film called The Day the Earth Stood Still, which was an old black and white movie with a robot called Gort. But it was bizarre that both of us looked at this person and knew that each other would actually recognize that he looked like a robot called Gort from a film, a black and white old film called The Day the Earth Stood Still.
It's so wonderful when you get a friend that you just like get each other. It's wonderful, you know, for friendship and a working relationship as well.
It was quite mad, yeah. It's cool.
I'm thinking about when you said you've met some very inspirational people and connecting this to travel, but it might be a little bit too much of a jump forward, but about the Mandela interview in Johannesburg at his house, which sounds incredible. But how did you get from that point where there you are studying accountancy, you started the Secret Agents that became a radio show, I think.
And then it became, goodness gracious me, on TV. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
So it was kind of, so yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, so that was great. But I mean, I guess, well, before that, in 1993, I'd already released an album called Spirit Dance. And then in 1994, I released Migration. So I'd already released Migration when it went to TV. And it was kind of a parallel thing, but I was also scoring films too, because I'd already done one for the BBC called Flight. So everything was kind of blossoming in terms of lots of different options I had as kind of my career path in a way. And so the comedy thing was doing really well, but I enjoyed doing it. It was really good fun. But I think it got to a point where I just thought, look, I need to make a choice, because actually, Warner Music, Rob Dickens at the time had asked me, if I wanted to produce an artist called Amar at the time. And so I thought, look, I can't do both. I've just only got so many hours in the day. So I need to just really devote myself to working on her album. And I pulled out the TV series, but not before I did the well-known Let's Go for an English sketch, where I did a Mooney and Bert. But I said a few things.
I mean, it is the best sketch ever. It's so funny. It's the blandest thing. It's the what's the blandest thing you've got? It's very, very
exactly.
Funny.
Well, it was me. Yeah, it was me saying, what was it? 24 plates of chips. I can't even remember.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but no, what was really funny about that was being in a Chinese restaurant where some people actually reenacted that whole sketch, not knowing that I was on the next table. Listening to them, which I found really funny, because they were actually doing my part. Someone was actually being me in the sketch, and they all knew it really well. I was like, wow, that's quite amazing.
Did you go over and say, hi guys, it's me? And I go, what?
No. I just found it really funny.
That sounds amazing. Were your parents disappointed that you didn't become an accountant?
No. Well, I did. I qualified as one.
Well. Oh, you did. Well done. Yeah.
But I didn't actually. Well, I was a financial controller of a hotel at one point, which was quite mad. But I left it to join James's band, and then never looked back. Really. I mean, I think my mum and dad had said, well, why don't you take a year and see how it goes. And if it doesn't work out, then maybe you should go back to accountancy. I said, okay, that's fair enough. So I did, and I needed
off.
To go back. Yeah,
at least you're really good at doing your own tax returns, right?
I don't do those. I don't do that. And I don't ever think about accountancy anymore. Thankfully, I'll maybe kind of, I can understand things. I mean, I'm on boards, like I'm the chair of the PRS Foundation, and I'm on board of Complicity, a theatre company, and so on. I'm on lots of boards. But it's helpful to understand financial statements and so on. But and that's great to help with charities and to help young talent that's emerging as well. But I think ultimately my main interest is in is always in music. Yeah.
From a travel point of view, I was just about to say about when did things start to take off, but I didn't do that on purpose, and I can't believe I've never used that sort of terrible aeroplane analogy before. But when did you start to, you know, to travel through work? Through my research that you recorded that album. Anyway,
yeah,
prophecy.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. So I guess, you know, as I'm saying, I mean, like things got, so I decided to focus more on music, you know, completely. And then obviously the next album, really, because I did Displacing the Priest was the last one I did while I was also working, goodness gracious me. And then the very next album was Beyond Skin. And Beyond Skin took off a lot. It kind of sold a lot of records. It was nominated for Mercury Prize and so on. So that was a really good time because suddenly a lot of record companies were chasing me. And then I signed to V2, which was Branson's second label. And then they said, what would you like to do for your album? And I said, well, I'd love to, you know, with Beyond Skin, it was made in a bedroom. But, for this album, I'd like to actually do the opposite. I'd like to go out in the world and see things and meet people and kind of make an album that's really about an experience. So it was kind of so it was actually from that point that I then went to lots of different countries like Brazil and India and South Africa and, and Spain, and lots of places where I kind of had different experiences and places that I was really interested in from the point of view of music, but also kind of discovering, a lot about those places. So, I kind of found that I just read Long Walk to Freedom. I literally finished the last page of the book Long Walk to Freedom in Nelson Mandela's garden. And then literally I finished the last page and walked in to see Nelson Mandela. And I knew so much about him because it was all fresh in my head because I just finished his biography, his autobiography. So I knew a lot about how he thought and how he articulated himself and so on. And he didn't disappoint. I mean, he was amazing, absolutely amazing and very elegant and very had a real gravitas to him. He was... what was interesting was that he was very funny. And he had a really good sense of humor. And then he switched as soon as I switched on my DAT machine to record him. He changed to become quite statesmanlike. And so a lot of the answers were very formal and officious, but also really heartfelt and really fantastic answers. But the most incredible thing was when, I think I've said this a few times in interviews, where his assistant came in and they called him Madiba and said, Madiba, the president's on the phone. He wants to speak to you. And he turned around to me and said, how many more questions have you got? And I've got a recording of this as well. And I said, I don't know, two or three. And he said, okay, could you ask him to call me back in 10 minutes? And that was amazing because that for me, I was really moved by that, actually, because first of all, I kind of found it almost amusing, but also mind-blowing because it struck me that his speech at Riviona, where he said he stood for the struggle of all people against oppression, not just Black South Africans, that he really had a sense of being an egalitarian in the truest sense of the word. That struck me very powerfully in that moment because I was, I realized I was sitting in front of somebody who was the real deal. And I'm quite cynical about politicians and I don't think much of them. The most politicians that I can see seem to be after power rather than fairness or thinking, about justice. But he was somebody who didn't. And you could see that from the fact that he also, gave up his presidency soon after he got it. He's probably one of, in terms of anyone I can think of, can't think of anyone who saw so much of oppression and power in one single lifetime. I mean, he went from being in prison in solitary confinement, for 19 years and 27 years in jail. And then, to being president of the country that had jailed him, so it's just an incredible journey that he went on. And I guess I had an amazing experience going to places like Australia during that trip as well, meeting Aboriginal Australians, Indigenous people who were incredibly welcoming and very enlightening and enlightened as people. And a lot of my travels during that time were made with the question in my mind of what development is, of the word development, because I guess people say we live in the developed world and we look at development in terms of construction and developments and buildings and technology and so on. But what was interesting was meeting people like Mantawai Yunupingu, who was an Aboriginal elder, who was from the band Yothu Yindi, and he was also a tribal elder in Arnhem Land. And I remember talking to him about the idea of colonization of the mind, which he talks about on that album. And he was kind of very articulate in talking about what he thought development meant. You know, that it was about people developing their minds and developing their balance with nature and with themselves. And I think that that's what true development is, you know, as people.
And to have that communication of music, you know, you don't even need to speak the same language. And we talked a little bit at the beginning about the on that same trip, you went to Spain to explore flamenco. But we talked a little bit about the connection between Indian music and flamenco, which I guess unless you're a musician and are involved in that world, and I'm involved through my brother, you know, people don't know about. And also the food, you know, about I think it's correct to say that chilies came from Portugal to India, you know, rather than the other way around, and pasta from, you know, China to Italy and China and that sort of thing. But to have that form of communication and that love of music, it's a wonderful unifier, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the best ways to actually look at understanding the connections between India and Spain in terms of the flamenco journey, or the journey of those gypsies of the room. So it's kind of like if you look at the Rajasthani gypsies, there's a film Lacho Drom. So it's by Tony Gatliff from 1993, and it charts that whole journey of gypsies pick up the Moorish traditions whilst on their route to Spain, and kind of you know, kind of also shows the early castanets, the Rajasthani gypsies in the deserts playing those, and also the early forms of dance, flamenco dance, which actually, you know, that you can even see similarities in the footwork of Kathak dancers. You know, it's really interesting when you see how flamenco and Kathak, Indian folk music, actually have a lot of similarities. So it's kind of, I mean, for example, in flamenco, you have the bulería, which is in 12 beat cycles, or you'll have soliar, and so a lot of it's in 12. You have in India, you have a 12 beat cycle called ekdal. It's not usual to have extended time cycles in the West, so it's kind of, you know, these things are kind of, you can see where these things originate. You know, I mean, with a bulería pattern, it's kind of like in triplets. With Indian classical music, it's kind of spoken as a deca, so it's spoken as a basis, is almost like a poetic basis to how it works. So it's din din dage tadikadun na katta dage tadikadin na. That's a 12 beat cycle, whereas in, you know, you with the bulería, it's kind of a different feel. But I've seen, you know, what was wonderful was seeing double players play, you know, because I've put double players who are classically trained with flamenco guitarists, and it's amazing how they immediately communicate and can bounce off each other. You know,
funny you should say that. My family in Fiji are all professional tabla players, or my cousins. Okay. And when my brother went over there for the first time, they all were just jamming. My brother on flamenco guitar and these guys on the tabla, and it worked amazingly.
There you go.
In fact, we grew up in Andalusia with an Indian Fijian dad and an English mum. Mm. And the gypsies were all around us. In fact, they were very fierce, and they were very, that really stood out, very Moorish, you know, very dark, prominent noses, hats, you know. They walk through the town and everyone would be like, you know, it was almost like coming into the guy with the guns walking into the Western town, you know. It was like really a bit hushed. And one of my earliest memories of seeing them was we were in a party at a stables in the middle of the countryside, a venta, they call it. And me and my friend sort of sneaked off next to the river in the dark, and we saw this big fire in the distance with people playing and the music, and it was a gypsy party, basically, with the flamenco and the guitars and the singing and the clapping and the offbeat clapping. And it was just like, you know, it gives me shivers even thinking about it. And I was only maybe 8 or 9 years old. And then later on, my brother became involved with he's got a lot of very gypsy friends. And actually, it's, you know, he will say that it's not easy to get in with these people. You know, you have to like take your time, be accepted, have the right introductions and that sort of thing. But he knows them very well now, and they you know, they class him as a brother. So on that trip to Spain, you know, that initial trip, the flamenco trip, what happened? What did you do there?
Oh, well, I worked with Pepe Habichuela a little bit and kind of got to know him. I knew him a bit before. I'd kind of worked with him on another thing. I mean, Pepe Habichuela was one of the foremost flamenco families in Spain, and he was based in Madrid, and his son is José Miguel Carmona from Ketama. And, you know, since then I've worked with a lot of flamenco bands like Ojos de Brujo, like flamenco hip hop and all that stuff. So I kind of loved all of that. But I think it's with Pepe, it was amazing to see how skillful, because, I mean, I was a huge fan of particularly, obviously, Paco de Lucía and later Tomatito and all these brilliant players. But it was amazing to see how elegant a player he was, because, I mean, you talk about Andalusia, and it's kind of, you know, if you think about, say, Segovia, actually, he said at one point that he wanted to take the guitar away from the noisy hands of flamenco guitarists. And it's kind of like, because he hated all of that tapping and all of the kind of power that they get. He had a much more kind of a different approach. And I mean, I love classical guitar as well, but it's a very different approach looking at the instrument more in an orchestral way and looking at different tonality. Pepe had all of that. He had all of that kind of classical finesse, as well as that fire that Paco had and the speed and the technique. And, you know, he'd grown up in the same way. I mean, Paco de Lucía had actually been taken out of school by his father, because his father was determined from when Paco de Lucía was a very, very small, when he was 3 or 4, that he would be the greatest guitarist in the world. That was his ambition. I mean, he succeeded. I mean, yeah. He's incredible. So, I mean, you know, it's amazing when you meet people at that level who are so committed. I mean, at one point, Pepe, you know, he kind of, we were jamming, and he looked at me this is from a guy who would practice like 14, 15 hours a day, every day, and had done since he was a kid. You know, that's all he lived and breathed was guitar. So at one point I'm playing with him and I'm aware that he's like unreal in terms of what he can do. And he looked at me, he said, very good, Nitin, very good. You need to practice more. It's kind of like, so it's like, I'm not going to practice 15 hours a day. It's just not going to happen. But yeah, I mean, it was, but we got on really well, and it was lovely. And yeah, I had a fantastic time in Spain. You know, and I always have done whenever I've gone over.
And also on that trip, you made, I think, what was your first trip to Brazil, to Rio?
Yeah, which was great. And I hung out with Sting over there, which was wonderful, and his family, who were amazing. But also he took me to the Mangueira Samba School, which was incredible, and to the favelas. And, you know, it was pretty good being around Sting, because he knew a lot of people. But I also was working with Nina Miranda at the time, and so who's Brazilian, and so I kind of met with a great arranger and composer called Dudu Falcao, and that was really cool. You know, just meeting a lot of local people and jamming with them was great. It was just very, very enlightening as an experience. It felt like I had my own personal renaissance, you know, by traveling in that way and meeting so many people from diverse backgrounds who had so much to say about music, but also about life experience.
That's again back to that whole communication, the great communicator that it is, music. And indeed, I'll put football in there as well, actually.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Anything like that you don't necessarily need to speak the same language.
Well, there you go. I mean, that was the thing with Gary Lineker recently, working with him, which is pretty cool, because it's interesting, because I think he's a very deep and intelligent man, and you know, it was great actually having him feature on this new album as somebody who can who comes from a football background but has a lot to say about the way the world is. So it hits on my new album. In fact, it came out as a single just a few days ago.
Oh, fantastic.
Days ago.
There we go.
yeah, and it's actually called Illegal. And I got him, he very graciously said that he'd come down to the studio and recorded his voice. I wrote some words for him. He recorded his voice speaking. And then I had some women from an Asian women's refuge who are refugees appearing on the track as well. Yeah, and it was great just kind of having their input alongside him speaking. And at the end, I got him to say the words, no one is illegal. And it's kind of, you know, it was in the wake of his disputes or kind of confrontation with Suella Braverman over the treatment and of refugees and asylum seekers.
I like how Twitter, I'm aware of that that spat, and I like how Twitter gives you an insight into people like that. And I love how people will express their opinions, even though it might get them in trouble with the BBC or whoever they happen to be working for.
Yeah,
and actually Gary Lineker, you know, to sort of chart his, I mean, you know, he's older than me, so I don't want to sound patronising, but because it's all out there with the media, to chart his progression from, you know, young kids kicking a ball around, doing well, to actually becoming, you know, educated, political, opinionated, and also
statesman as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's great. Yeah.
It's really, really, really wonderful to see, isn't it, when that happens.
And the thing is, you know, you get all these trolls and so on. It's like, it's very easy to shoot them down just by saying, well, how many caps have you had for England?
Yeah.
You know, you're turning around and shooting him down on the basis of patriotism. You know, and it's kind of, it strikes me as really funny. It's kind of, it's those times when you see these trolls coming out and saying, you're not British at all. And I say, excuse me, actually, I'm a commander of the most excellent order of the British Empire, which I wouldn't want to have after my name. It's kind of like, if you're going to get into a debate about that, that's what I find funny. By the way, on that note, it was quite amusing to me that the whole thing that happened around that, because a lot of people said, how come you took that? How come you took a CBE? And it's very simple. I mean, basically, I had turned down an OBE in I think it was in 2000, either 2005 or 2007, on the basis of what happened with, particularly what happened with the war in Iraq, and also, didn't really want the word empire after my name. But then my dad had said, well, wouldn't you take it for me for my birthday as a present to me, because it's an indication of how far we've come as immigrants that you can get this, you know. And it's really fantastic that we've got, you know, it's for our whole family. And I said, I just can't do it. Now, the thing is, he passed away in 2013, and then in 2018 on his birthday, what would have been his birthday, I got sent a letter saying, do you want the CB? And I thought, well, that's kind of a sign. Mm. So I thought, okay, I'll take it. So then I was given it on what would have been his anniversary with Mum on May the 9th. And these are all just coincidences. And I kind of thought, well, you know, that there's an indication of something there. So I took it for those reasons. I guess I also feel... there's part of me that also thinks, I don't really see any white people having to justify why they take an honour. Why should an Asian person or a black person have to do that? You know, it's like, it's for, it's an acknowledgement of us being good at what we do. So I thought, well, you know, there isn't anything else that really does that on a serious, you know, national scale. In France, they call it Knight of Arts and Letters. Here you get an honour. But I mean, it still strikes me as funny when people are trolling me and say, you're not British and so on. It's kind of like, what about CB?
You go, mate. Yeah, look at this. Have you got one of those? Yeah, I think you can be all of those things. You can be from here, but have origins and heritage somewhere else. You can be proud of here, but also call out the injustices, not hide what we're doing wrong, talk about that, you know, analyze the government, criticize the government. And we're incredibly lucky that we live in a place where we're able to do that. And you can absolutely be proud of getting your CBE and pick apart the government as well. It doesn't, you know, just because you have one, it doesn't mean you can't do the other. In fact, I think it makes it more valid that you can do that, you know, that you have that opinion, and it's a beautiful thing. And some people would say there are no coincidences. I mean, I don't know where I stand on that, but
I have a lot of them, so I don't know what you call them. I mean, I think there are patterns in the universe that kind of materialize in different ways. I think I kind of believe in what's known as panpsychism to some degree, which is the idea that consciousness is in everything, and that the universe itself has a consciousness, and that actually, you know, we're just manifestations of that temporarily in this form, but, you know, ultimately we return back to a sea of consciousness. And that's kind of the way I tend to think. So when we look at coincidences, I think it's about bigger patterns, patterns that we don't necessarily understand, but emerge from universal consciousness.
We haven't touched remotely on your travels because there's so many other things to do. But I'm thinking now of going back to what you were saying there and back to India, which is a very a spiritual place, a religious place, yet also a place where life and death are very much present, much more present and accepted and talked about and
coexist
exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas here we sort of brush that stuff under the carpet because we find it upsetting and uncomfortable. And, you know, maybe your background from these two worlds, you know, enables you to look at things that, like we've been talking about, and to, you know, to explore those.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I quite often stay at a place called Varna, which is it's a yoga retreat in the foothills of the Himalayas in Dehradun. And it's a brilliant place. They have Ayurvedic medicine and food there, and they also do macrobiotic food, and then they have Ayurvedic treatments, traditional Chinese medicine, Tibetan healing. They do non-chlorine-based natural filtration systems, swimming pools and all kinds of things. And it's in the forest, so you'll have like wildlife roaming around. It's quite an incredible experience to go there. So I love traveling there and find that I feel 10 million times better every single time I come back. I mean, you lose weight very quickly, insane speed. I mean, basically you lose a pound a day every single time I've gone there. That's what I've lost. And it's all toxins. And, you know, because you're eating just incredible food, and it's just a very natural environment to be in. And you get lots of treatments which actually help you to lose that weight. So it's kind of, you know, but in a really healthy way. So it feels fantastic actually going there.
I was going to ask you actually, where have you felt happiest on your travels? But I'm coming up to my last question in a sec, because I'm aware we've been speaking for an hour, it's gone quickly. I was going to ask you where you felt happiest on your travels. What's the worst thing that's ever happened to you on your travels?
Oh, what's the worst? Oh my God. That was in LA when I actually I had food poisoning in LA. And I was, it was really bad food poisoning. And I remember I basically, I thought they were going to kind of, you know, look out for making me feel better or whatever, but instead I was kind of I had a terrible experience. I had to go through all kinds of bureaucracy and they weren't going to let me in the country, and then I had to I was all during which I was being really violently sick, and then I was taken to a hospital where they'd already taken everything from me. They said, you need to give us your wallet. You need to give us your, you know, all of your documents, everything. You can't have anything on you. I was like, that's crazy. Why? And they just said, we need it all. We don't have to tell you why. We just take it. So basically they took everything from me, then take me to a hospital where they said, we can't do anything until you pay us $200. And I said, $200 for what? And they said, to look at you, to examine you. I said, this is insane. I haven't got any money on me. I mean, I can give you my address. And, you know, so eventually, after about another hour of kind of talking this through, they agreed to do that. Then I was put in a room on my own in isolation for 6 hours. I was still being sick. I wasn't allowed out of the room. And there was no sink. So I was literally just being sick. And then eventually after 6 hours, a doctor came in and said, oh my God, you've been really sick. I said, well, yeah. I wasn't allowed out. He said, that's ridiculous. He said, what's wrong? I said, well, I've got food poisoning and I got it from the airport. And he said, right. Well, you seem really dehydrated. Have you had any water? I said, no. So he said, well, here's a load of water. You just need to have lots of water, electrolytes. I said, yeah, I know that. Can I go now? He said, yeah, yeah, you can go. So it's like I went off and just went back to my hotel and just slept for 24 hours.
Oh, my God. Is that, if that's the hospital experience, can you imagine what the prison experience is going to be like? God. And I think that's overzealous US customs officers. I remember being, and I don't know if it's a color thing or whatever, and I'm sure it's probably worse being a man than being a woman, but I remember going through Vegas once and they were like, well, what are you doing here? I was like, well, it's Vegas. Like, I've come for a couple of weeks. You know, I was with friends, but they were walking behind me and they sort of, so maybe thought I was on my own. Well, why are you here? What's, you know, and it's like, it's Vegas. I'm just here, you know, just here to party or whatever. And they can get a little bit officious.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. Well, you weren't put in prison then?
No, exactly. That was it.
Actually, when I was in Japan, I went to Osaka, which was really bad as well. I mean, that was an awful experience. Basically, totally bizarre. I was kind of, they kept, I mean, I was actually supposed to stay in the hotel on my way back to the UK. And I booked a hotel in the airport itself. I didn't even have to go out anywhere. And I was stopped at customs. I mean, and the woman wouldn't look at me. It was so rude. So rude the way they behaved. I mean, she wouldn't look me in the eye. She wouldn't speak in English. She just literally was talking to someone on the phone to get them to come and arrest me. No reason at all. So they come, grab me, and I said, "What are you doing?" And then they marched me off to this room and put me in there with no explanation. And then a while later, they give me this form to fill in of what I'm doing there. And it has the most racist questions, and it's where are you from, where's your father from, all kinds of stuff. And it's like, I just put not applicable across the whole thing. I was so angry, and they wouldn't let me out for a bit. So 3 hours later, they did, and I came out. I was so angry at that point, and the guy just said to me, he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm staying in a hotel in the airport." He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "From England." And he goes, "You don't look English." I was like, do you know how racist you sound? Yeah. And he said, and his answer to that, which is the weirdest answer, was, "Don't you have racism in England?" I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." Yeah, I said, "I don't know what you're talking about. Am I free to go or am I under arrest?" And he said, he threw my form at me. He said, "You didn't fill this in properly." I said, "I'm not going to fill it in. I'm going to walk out of here. If you want to arrest me, you can. And then we'll take out with the British Council or the British Embassy." And he said, "You're free to go." I said, "Thanks for your hospitality."
It's not always easy, is it? It's not always easy.
But I mean, having said that, I still do love Japanese culture and love Japan. I mean, I loved going to Tokyo. It was an amazing experience, and played the Blue Note there. They were so kind and really lovely to me. So, I mean, you know, you get some assholes some places and really cool people in others, you know, it's kind of, or in the same place even sometimes. So people are just people, you know, ultimately that's the thing you realise. And they'll look for excuses, and racism is an excuse to be an asshole, really. I mean, because those people are frustrated human beings who aren't happy with their own lives, who need to scapegoat someone else for all their problems.
You get arseholes in Kent, you get arseholes in Tokyo, but you get good people all over the world as well.
100%, yeah.
Seems like a fitting place for me to ask you my last question. My last question is always about music, because I think that you and I would both agree that I think music and travel very much go hand in hand, and it helps cement a memory and time of place and travel. So my question is, if you had to pick one song that, if I could afford to, I'd play as we were, you know, as we were leaving. But if you had to pick one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song and what is the memory?
Well, actually, it would probably be one of mine, weirdly enough, because it'd probably be Moonrise, which I recorded with Cheb Mami in Paris, but also with Jose Miguel Carmona in Spain, and then with the strings recorded in Brazil, in Rio, and then me recording my some of the other stuff there for the track in London, and the percussion was recorded in percussion as well. So it's kind of it was from four different countries, so it was a nice track to have created in that way.
feels like it was a seminal moment in your career and development as a musician.
I think so. I think that track, you know, like the track Homelands on Beyond Skin, it was about, I think it was about feeling that I'm a citizen of the world, much to the dismay of people like Theresa May, I should imagine. But I mean, you know, I am a citizen of the world. We all are, really. But it's kind of, you know, the trick is to make us believe that we live in parochial pockets of ignorance, and that's the thing. So I kind of, I feel that, and I think that music kind of epitomizes that.
I've got so much more I can ask you, but I'm aware that I'm using all your time. So thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Cool. Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nitin Sawhney. I honestly could have spoken to you for hours and hours. And thank you for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. We honestly appreciate each and every one of you.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.